Thank you, David. And thank all of you for coming out tonight to this function at the Independent Institute. Even though I've been working with David for some 20 years and formally working with the Independent Institute for 10 years now, I don't work from this office, so I'm not here very often and am not able to enjoy functions like this myself. And I guarantee you I would enjoy much more being in the audience of such an evening than I would enjoy being here as the speaker. But I have this book, and David has led me to believe that it would be a good idea to discuss it with those who might be interested in reading it and perhaps telling others about it and helping us to spread our understanding of a number of important public policy issues. This is more fun for me than the usual talk I might give because in the audience tonight are some very old friends of mine, some of whom I haven't seen since the 1960s when they were classmates of mine in college. I graduated from San Francisco State College, as it was called in those days. And even my oldest friend on this earth is here tonight, who's been my friend from the day I was born. And so my brother is here, and I've never had him in the audience before either, and that's really going to make me nervous. But please bear with me. I don't pretend to be a public speaker. I do work as an editor, and when time permits, I enjoy writing. But public speaking is something that comes along and strikes me like bolts of lightning every once in a while, and I'm always wondering why this keeps happening to me over and over. It's as if people don't learn not to invite me again. But I want to tell you a little bit about this new book and perhaps encourage you, if you've purchased a copy, to actually read some of it. Or perhaps it'll work the other way around. Once I tell you about it, you'll be thoroughly convinced you don't want to have anything to do with it. But either way, something will have been gained by you, if not by me. This book, Against Leviathan, is a collection, and that's not a recommendation in general when authors have collected works of their writings over a period of time. In this case, the contents of the book began as articles and chapters and independent papers that were published over a period of almost a quarter of a century. The oldest piece goes back to 1981, but the big majority of what's in the book comes from things I wrote in the past decade. So I tried not to include anything that was definitely dated. Even though some of the pieces make reference to events and policies and other matters that were current long ago, these are matters that recur. They keep becoming relevant again and again and again. So I do believe that history has something to teach us. I do not believe in laws of history. That's an indefensible doctrine. But even though there are no ironclad laws of history, there are recurrent patterns. And we can learn enough about history to recognize when the conjunction of events is such that we might well expect the same sort of consequences we've seen in the past. And it was on that basis that My book, Crisis and Leviathan, took on a kind of second life after September 11th, 2001. I got a number of calls from journalists and others asking me to comment because I think a number of people recognize themselves, having read my book, that we might be on the verge of another episode of, as that book says, Crisis and Leviathan, an episode in which some grave national emergency is the trigger for a spurt in the growth of government power. And I agreed at the time when I was approached that we could expect that, and I believe that in retrospect now, with 3 years to look back on, we have indeed witnessed another episode, not comparable thus far to what we saw in either World War or the Great Depression, but certainly similar in many of its general aspects. So the title of this book, Against Leviathan, serves two purposes. On the one hand, it calls the reader's attention to the book's being a kind of sequel to the earlier book, Crisis and Leviathan. And indeed, many of the chapters in this collection amount to extensions or applications of ideas and themes that appeared in the earlier book, but I have, in the past 20 years, worked to develop, to extend, to apply, to dig deeper, to obtain more details on certain matters, so that even though it's in some ways not a formal sequel, it definitely amounts to that in many respects. In addition, the idea Against Leviathan gives you a hint as to how I feel about the size, scope, and power of government in this country today. I hold liberty in great esteem, and I believe liberty has been declining in this country, not in every respect and not every year, but in general, it's been declining for some 100 years or more. And I'm sorry that that has been the way history has unfolded. I believe in free society, and I'm dismayed when I look back on our history and see all the various ways in which I believe the American people have made a bad bargain. And so the idea Against Leviathan expresses a kind of testimony that I want to make, that some of us stood athwart history and said, this is no good. Now, the book is all about government in many different respects, and of course, that's been the topic for countless philosophers and social scientists and thinkers of all sorts. And I don't pretend that I am offering in this book something that belongs on the shelf with John Locke's treatises or some of the great works of social science or history that deal with this topic. I've tried to make a contribution in my career, but I don't deceive myself that I've done this at a terribly elevated level. One of the things I believe I've come to understand is that there are certain aspects of government that are fundamental. Many analysts have defined government as that collection of people and institutions that claims a monopoly of legitimate coercive force. That is those people who think they have a right to use violence as opposed to the rest of us who may do so only with their approval. So violence is really part and parcel of government, and many of us don't recognize it because it's normally in reserve. It's just out there held back, and our rulers don't like to use violence for the most part. They would rather just have people fall into line with what they want us to do. But if push comes to shove, they're prepared to use violence. And indeed, a government that isn't so prepared will probably not remain a government very long. And an alternative way to think about government is that collection of persons who possess a comparative advantage in the use of violence. They've demonstrated it. That's why they're the government. If they can't continue to demonstrate it, they will probably cease to be the government at some point. As I say, however, governments don't like to use violence, especially against their own people, unless challenged seriously. And in order to avoid having to use violence in order to do what they want, they resort to bamboozlement. There has often been a kind of union of throne and altar in history, going back to the Egyptian dynasties and many other ancient governments. In some cases, the rulers were even themselves supposed to be gods. And if they weren't supposed to be gods themselves, they were supposed to be blessed by the gods. And so all rulers seek legitimacy in some way. They've sought it in many different forms of legitimation. In modern times, they seek it not so much from divine legitimation as from some doctrine, whether it's democracy writ large or communism or perhaps in some cases Islam. They all have a body of ideology that they use to, among other things, legitimize and even glorify what they do. What they do being, at least in part, plundering the people they rule, because they all have to have resources at some level to operate at all. And in many cases, they wish to control vast resources. And so they need to do a lot of plundering, and they need deep legitimation to get away with that so that people won't just resist, even rebel against the government. So bamboozlement is part and parcel of what every government does. David actually preempted me. He didn't know that I was planning to use that same quotation from H.L. Mencken, but now you know that indeed all governments thrive on public fear. They like to keep people scared of things. Indeed, I'll give you an assignment. I used to be a professor, so here's an assignment to those of you who came to my class tonight. As you watch the news, especially if you happen to watch, say, CNN's headline news as a convenience or just as kind of self-punishment, I ask you to, in each full news program of half an hour, whether it's on one of the networks or somewhere else, to identify each time the scare du jour. Is it a new chemical that is feared to be loose in the environment that could wreak havoc on our health? Is it a terrorist attack? Are they about to come ashore in Alameda County? What is it today? And I believe you'll find that if you're sensitive to it, you'll see that there's a scare du jour every day. Now, some of them recur. They used that one last week, perhaps, and it's still fresh. So they're using that one again. But they try to find new ones because they don't want us to begin to think that they're like the little boy who cried wolf. After a while, we'll think there is no wolf if they keep crying the same wolf and he never comes. So fresh ones are useful. And you may be wondering, well, didn't I slip from the government to CNN? Well, not exactly. They're connected. They are connected. The major media are handmaidens, like it or not, for the government. They like to look critical and investigative and all that, but that's a hoax. When it comes to fundamentals, they shore up the status quo, and they have definite limits on how far they will go to question, challenge, or even dig into uncomfortable facts. Scandal's okay because scandal doesn't really threaten anything fundamental. That's a personal thing and really a form of amusement for modern Americans. It's like soap opera to track down Bill Clinton's latest peccadillo. But the media definitely have clear limits, and for the most part, they play a role that is complementary to what the state wishes to do. The state claims, of course, at all times and places that it's providing a service that we not only want but must have. And they claim that we can't get this service from any alternative supplier. And it's basically protection and justice. All of these threats, all of these hobgoblins, or perhaps sometimes even real threats, get people alarmed, and they want a savior. They want protection. I don't want to appear that I'm claiming all threats are imaginary. Real threats sometimes exist, and people definitely want genuine security. There's a genuine public demand for personal security. If you've ever had the misfortune of living in a time and place where that was not available to you, then you know how precious it can be and how valuable it is and how much you would give to have it. But whether the threat is real or imaginary, people want security from some source, and the government pretends to provide that security. Or if it hasn't visibly provided it lately, it claims that it's fixing the problem and everything will be okay. It's true, of course, that some people knocked down two big buildings in New York recently, but that was then, and they're fixing that problem now. So trust them. Okay? They're working on it. What I show, I believe, in the book Against Leviathan, again and again, in specific applications, is that these claims are bogus. The government doesn't really provide much effective protection to any of us, with the possible exception of some government officials. You'll notice they have special facilities and methods and procedures worked out to protect themselves when they get scared. And they can scurry off like rabbits to their bunkers while you and I sit out here in the open. But other than protecting themselves, they really don't do a good job of protecting us. Even the police of various kinds normally come along after a crime has been committed and take some notes. They don't prevent the crime from being committed in the first place. If you want that to be done, you'd better hire some private security. But what we're dealing with here, I think, boils down to fraud. And indeed, in the introduction to this book, I dwell on that a little bit. Let me just read that paragraph. If I had to use a single word to describe what is fundamentally wrong with government today, I would use the word fraud. Certainly nowadays, and perhaps in every age, government is not what it claims to be, namely competent, protective, and just. And it is what it claims not to be, namely bungling, menacing, and unjust. In actuality, it is a vast web of deceit and humbug, and not for a good purpose either. Indeed, its true purposes are as reprehensible as its noble claims are false. Its stock in trade is pretense. The velvet glove of its countless claims of benevolence scarcely conceals its iron fist of violence and threats of more violence. It wants to be loved, but it will settle for being feared. The one thing it will not do is simply leave us alone. Now, if you think that sounds like bombast, I'll forgive you. But the book is not just 400 pages like that. Indeed, it is, for the most part, quite detailed, and I've tried to provide evidence and documentation for the factual claims I make. And even in the more polemical chapters, I've tried to provide, in every case, an analytical core. There's a point, a logic. There's an argument there. It's not just a lot of op-eds strung end to end. I don't, as I say, imagine that I'm John Locke. I know better than that. I do recommend you read Locke, though. It still fires me up even today. Actually makes me mad to read Locke's second treatise. I don't know if it's ever had that effect on anybody else, but some of those American revolutionaries seem to have dwelt on it before they went out. So maybe I'm not the first. But this book is not a book of philosophy. It's a book more about history, more about the concrete than about the abstract. I'm not a general theorist. I sometimes resort to general analysis and general propositions, although I can't claim to have invented many of them myself. I draw on a great heritage of thought related to this subject area. But what I've tried to do is to show that to concrete facts accord with some general propositions in case after case. And I've been at this now for some 40 years. My old friend Dennis McDonald, sitting in the back of the room there, can testify that I started out on this no later than 1963 when I met him. And we used to sit over in the Commons at San Francisco State, and I would rant and rave. So I've been thinking about these things and thinking about how these facts line up for a long time now, and what you get in this book is some of what I've found in 40 years of looking. So it is pretty concrete, and sometimes the concrete can be startling. Let me just give you some examples. There's a brief chapter. Chapter 6 is called Bolingbroke, Nixon, and the Rest of Them. And this is about people who hold positions of political power. This is generally what they're doing and how they're going about doing it. And along the way, I have occasion to quote from some of the famous Nixon tapes. There was a real politician, a man who held a position of great political power for some time. And one day he was talking to Haldeman and Ehrlichman, his right-hand men, in the Oval Office, and the tape recorder was grinding away. And Nixon was asking about their new commissioner of internal revenue. And he said, "I want to make sure he's a ruthless son of a bitch, that he will do what he is told, that every income tax return I want to see, I see." That he will go after our enemies and not go after our friends. It's as simple as that. Well, there's democracy in action, folks. Did you ever wonder what they say in private? Well, that's what he said in private. I'm sure he didn't say that for posterity. Well, he went on. He was somewhat obsessed with this issue, evidently because his returns had been audited in the early 1960s. And it turns out that President Kennedy was of the same mind as Nixon when it came to using the IRS to get his enemies. And Nixon had been among them, so he had been audited. Nixon seems to have believed that his predecessors had used the IRS against him. So a few days later, he asked Ehrlichman if he had ascertained, quote, who ordered the audit of my income tax returns in 1961? And he continued to talk to his aides about this. He thought he could use it to get at some of the people who were supporting political opponents. He instructed Ehrlichman to sic the IRS on wealthy Jewish contributors to his Democratic rivals. On September the 8th of 1973, he said, John, that was Ehrlichman, John, we have the power. Are we using it now to investigate contributors to Hubert Humphrey, contributors to Muskie, the Jews, you know, that are stealing in every direction? Are we going after their tax returns? I can only hope that we are, frankly, doing a little persecuting. And who said he had no sense of humor? He told on September the 13th, Nixon told Haldeman, now here's the point, Bob. Please give me the names of the Jews. You know, the big Jewish contributors to the Democrats. The president wanted them investigated. Next day, speaking to Haldeman and Charles Colson, another aide, and he came back to this. He said, what about the rich Jews? The IRS is full of Jews, Bob. And later he admonished, go after them like a son of a bitch. That's the man who stood up and told us, I am not a crook. So what they say to the public and what they say in private are very different. And it's not just Nixon, my friends. It's not just Nixon. Well, let me give you a different slant on some concrete government officials' statements. This one was actually made in public, which makes it even more shocking. For most of the 1990s, the Commissioner of Food and Drugs was a man named David Kessler. And Kessler worked very hard to make the FDA an even more fearsome police agency than it had ever been before. And he succeeded. It had many ill consequences for public health and other valuable things such as our liberty, but on one occasion Kessler said the following: if members of our society were empowered to make their own decisions about the entire range of products for which the FDA has responsibility, then the whole rationale for the agency would cease to exist. To argue that people ought to be able to choose their own risks, that government should not intervene, is to impose an unrealistic burden on people when they are most vulnerable to manufacturers' assertions. Those are precisely the situations in which the legal and ethical justifications for the FDA's existence is greatest. Well, if you can find a public statement of more outrageous moral audacity than that, I would like to know what it is. A man who thinks that a government bureaucracy ought, rather than the people whose own lives are at stake, to make the decisions about their life and death. In the book, I present a good deal of evidence. I've worked on FDA myself for a number of years, and I present evidence I accumulated along with others that the number of premature deaths brought about by FDA action, directly and indirectly, is at least an order of magnitude greater than the number of lives saved by that agency. And in all probability, hundreds of thousands of Americans have died prematurely, and countless people all over the world have suffered as a result of that protective agency. The protection is a fraud. It's a hoax. Everybody who's ever looked at the FDA, for example, has noticed that it could make mistakes. The FDA could, when it goes to consider approving the marketing of new products, medical devices, drugs, other things, it could make a mistake by failing to approve a product that is safe and effective, or it could make a mistake by approving a product that is not safe or not effective. And so, given that it can make two kinds of mistakes, the very first thing one would want to do if one were really responsible is try to find out where the balance is being struck. Are we making more type 1 errors than type 2? If so, we're wreaking harm. But they have never even considered making such a study. All such considerations have had to be made by outsiders such as myself, who of course don't have access to nearly the information that the agency has inside. But they're not interested in making that study. In fact, when this point is raised for them, they fall back on the assertion that they're just a police agency enforcing the law, even though the law is what it is because of their relentless lobbying. They being the most powerful lobbyist of all in matters pertaining to the agency's jurisdiction. So there's a concrete case of the kind of protection we get from government, and it's a serious matter. More people have died as a result of the FDA's actions than have died in all the wars this country has fought in the 20th century. I have no doubt of that. Well, there's the welfare state, of course. We all love the welfare state. There is, I think, another vast fraud. Hydra-headed legal and bureaucratic monstrosity that purports to protect people from every common adversity of life while redistributing income and wealth in serene disregard of that redistribution's many destructive consequences for the entire society. This gigantic undertaking fails every moral and practical test imaginable, nor do its consequences take their toll once and for all. Far worse, they eat away at the moral, social, and economic foundations of what was once a considerably more honest and self-reliant culture. You notice now that both political parties simply compete to make the bigger promise of expanding the welfare state. And the so-called conservative Republicans under the current president just made the biggest increment to the already bankrupt Medicare system since its inception. And the $500 billion dollars they claim it's going to cost over the next decade will, I guarantee you, be but a small fraction of its actual cost. When the Medicare system itself was first put into operation in the mid-1960s, they had cost estimates, and 20 years later, the actual cost was 20 or 30 times greater than they had estimated it would be. I don't recall the exact proportion, but it was much, much, much bigger, and that is how all of these forecasts of welfare state costs have worked. They all turn out to be hugely expensive. But that's not all they do. They have other kinds of costs, as I say. They have moral costs. They have costs in social disorganization. I live now in southeast Louisiana, about 40 miles from New Orleans. And if you want to see how the welfare system can wreck an entire city, visit New Orleans. It's the poster child of the welfare state. That was a decent city once upon a time, notwithstanding its amusements. A place where people did honest work to provide those amusements. No longer. Corrupt to the core, people living on crime and welfare. So, I have in the book an opening section on the welfare state. Well, the welfare state is a kind of soft despotism that the FDA, these other health and welfare pretenses. But the modern state also has hard despotism, the kind that uses the guns first and asks questions later. And one of the chief expressions of the hard despotism is the so-called war on drugs. And I have several chapters dealing with that in the book, including one called Lock 'em Up, which has to do with the growth of the inmate population in this country. We now have 7 million people who are either behind bars, that's about 2 million behind bars, and 5 million others who are on probation or parole right now. And that number has grown about threefold in the last 20 years. And a big part of why it's grown so greatly is because of the drug laws, the prohibition of the use of certain drugs. And, of course, many, many evil consequences have come from the prohibition of these drugs, just as evil consequences came out of the prohibition of alcohol back in the 1920s. So, I do have something to say about hard despotism also. Blending into the soft despotism on one end and the hard despotism on the other has been increasingly the growth of something that has been called the therapeutic state. Sometimes people refer to the nanny state when they want to criticize it. My friend Thomas Soz, some of you may know, he is the great writer on the therapeutic state. If you haven't dipped into his work, I heartily recommend it. He's written for my journal, The Independent Review, and I'm very proud that he has contributed. I consider him one of the great defenders of liberty in our day. But he's written much about the therapeutic state, particularly as it's expressed by the combination of psychiatry and criminal justice, involuntary commitment, and related issues. So we have proceeding hand in hand with the futile crusade against drugs and advancing secular therapeutic ethos in which every human misstep represents a disease from which only a government-imposed treatment can save us. And in this way, a cultural development that might otherwise have been dismissed as merely misguided or silly has greased the skids for ever more intrusive government actions that now penetrate homes, schools, courtrooms, prisons, and a variety of other venues in a quest to save people from their insufficient self-esteem and the manifold maladies to which that insufficiency supposedly gives rise, all such programs resting, as usual, on threats of government violence. Well, I'm an economist, and I haven't said anything so far about government management of the economy, so I should say a little bit about that. I brought some data with me just to highlight some of what David mentioned in the introduction. Government has been growing much faster lately in connection with this latest crisis of September 11 and its aftermath. Now on the graph, we have some data starting in 1990, running up to 2005, the last 2 years being projections or estimates from the government's budgets. But this shows the annual increase in total federal outlays, and as you can see, they've jumped up pretty much to double their level of the preceding decade during the Bush presidency. Federal spending has been growing about 8% a year under Bush, roughly twice as fast as it grew under the dreaded Bill Clinton, that all the conservatives accused of fiscal profligacy. It doesn't matter now, of course, to conservatives. It's all okay because it's all to allay the terrorist threat. Just to emphasize again how extraordinary the current episode is, we have here the years in which the increase in real discretionary federal outlays were greatest. And Lyndon Johnson gets the prize for the two years with the fastest growth. But the next three go to George W. Bush from fiscal years 2002, 3, and 4. And there's not a whole lot of hope on the horizon for a slowdown here. So if you like runaway government spending, then I guess the current administration is your cup of tea. But if you think that raises certain economic and other problems, then you might want to rethink your support of the current administration. It's not all the administration's fault, I might add. Congress and both parties have been in the trough with both feet, furiously buying votes in all directions where they think a vote can be bought. So the Democrats in Congress have been fully involved in this, and indeed one of the unfortunate aspects of crisis is that they're dealt with by bringing all the parties that have any political clout into the game simultaneously, because the usual trade-offs no longer have to be made in a crisis. People will tolerate more plunder in a crisis, and so all the plunderers have a field day at once. I have one more display here that emphasizes that aspect. In this, we have the real discretionary outlays in levels here, and as you can see, adjusted for inflation, back in Reagan's day, non-defense discretionary outlays didn't really make any headway. Defense outlays were built up, of course. And then they came together again after Reagan was about to leave office. But what you see lately is that both defense and non-defense are moving almost on the same track, so that if the Democrats have their favorite set of boondoggles, then the Bush administration is perfectly happy to pay them off and give them what they want in exchange for their supporting the administration in things like the adventures in Iraq and most of the rest of the world. So you can turn it off. As I've already mentioned, public fear plays an indispensable role in these crisis episodes. It's the mother's milk of all modern government. And if no crisis came along, then the government would be more or less compelled to invent some crisis. And it's for that reason that we have scares du jour, just to keep us going between the major events. Well, I've talked probably long enough to give you a flavor of the book Against Leviathan, so I will close. We have time for questions and answer.